Amen. Okay, hopefully you all got your notes. We're going to start. The portion is Chukat. It means statutes. It starts in chapter 19, but we're going to pick it up with an interesting verse in chapter 20, in verse 1. Okay? What makes it interesting is how little is said about this event, especially when you compare it with what turns out to be the deaths of other people in the Bible. We know much more about them and what was done. It says, in the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh, and it says, there Miriam died and was buried. Period. Six words. Right? Now, when Aaron dies, a few verses later, there is a ceremony in which his mantle of authority is passed to his son, Eleazar. He is buried. The community mourns for him. The community mourns for 30 days, which provides the basis for part of our mourning ritual. And we'll talk about that a little bit too. But there is a lot said about the death of Aaron, a lot said about the death of Moses. There was a lot said when Sarah died, a lot said when Abraham died. Sometimes there is a great deal of attention given to the deaths of prominent people, and certainly Miriam was among those, a very prominent leader in the community. In fact, the rabbis refer to three messiahs that delivered Israel from Egypt: Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So they consider her a deliverer as well. Okay? So we just want to keep that in mind because it's something that Sachs brings up in his comments on this portion. Because this is immediately followed by what it says in verse 2. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, "If we had only died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this wilderness, that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place?" And arguably, Egypt was the terrible place, and the wilderness was the place on the way to the promised land. But they continue, "It has no grain or figs, grapevines, pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." Moses and Aaron went down from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together." And then God gives him very, very specific instructions regarding what to do. He says, "Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water." Okay, now this is similar to what happened on the first occasion when the community complained about the lack of water. And Moses was instructed to take his staff and to strike the rock with the staff. And of course, when he does so, water gushes forth from the rock, right? We're all familiar with that story. This one, however, is in many ways more poignant because God tells Moses to take his staff on this occasion as well, but he says when he gets to the rock, don't strike it, speak to the rock before the eyes of the community, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so they and their livestock can drink. So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence just as he commanded him. So at this point, everything looks good. He and Aaron gather the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses says to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with the staff. Right? And even without a commentary, you get a sense, based upon what happens here, that Moses is a bit out of sorts, you could say, because he doesn't typically respond. He doesn't typically respond in this way. I mean, even when Korach and his company came and, you know, and challenged the leadership of Moses and Aaron, I mean, he says some strongly worded things, but he doesn't come across this way. And that could be said of many of the occasions when Moses is challenged. But here, he just turns to them and says, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff, and water gushed out. And the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land that I gave them." Right? So many people ask, why wasn't Moses allowed to take the Jewish people into the promised land? And the explanation, even though it requires, some commentary to really come to terms with, is stated right here. Moses is told that he will not lead the Jewish people into the promised land because you, Moses, did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites. Right? So what does that mean? Moses did not sanctify God's name in the presence of the people of Israel. Right? So there is a good deal of commentary about what happened and why. And if you're interested, please avail yourself of one of the previous studies, one of the verse-by-verse studies on this section. But it goes on and says, "These were the waters of Meribah," which is the Hebrew word for quarrel, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and where he was proven holy among them. Okay? So Jonathan Sacks is going to write what I consider to be one of his most poignant commentaries to date. I mean, I love Jonathan Sacks. I love his insights. I love the connections he makes between texts. But this one is very, very moving. Probably in part because in the beginning he describes what he went through when his father died. And, of course, it is very easy for me to relate to the comments that he makes because I felt some of the exact same things and just wasn't able to communicate it quite as elegantly. But this commentary is called Healing the Trauma of Loss. Okay? "It took me 2 years," he says, "to recover from the death of my father of blessed memory. To this day," he says, "almost 20 years later, I am not sure why. He did not die suddenly or young. He was well into his 80s. In his last years, he had to undergo 5 operations, each of which sapped his strength a little more. Besides which," he says, "as a rabbi, I had to officiate at funerals and comfort the bereaved. I knew what grief looked like." The rabbis were critical of one who mourns too much, too long. They said that God himself says of such a person, and of course this is a commentary, a midrash, God himself says of such a person, "Are you more compassionate than I am?" Maimonides rules, a person should not become excessively brokenhearted because of a person's death. As it says, "Do not weep for the dead, nor bemoan him." Quote from Jeremiah. But this means, do not weep excessively. Obviously, We are supposed to grieve when we lose a loved one, but there is supposed to be some measure of balance between grieving and staying connected to people and staying connected to the Lord, of course, and to what we've been called to and doing whatever it is that we are supposed to be doing, right? At any rate, Sack says this means do not weep excessively, for death is the way of the world. And it's something that we all know. If death hasn't affected you personally yet, it will. It's inevitable. You know that old cliche, the two constants in the world, death and taxes, right? I mean, it's true of every generation, of every time, and it has been true, forever. And it will continue to be true forever, right? Death is the way of the world. It's just what happens, and it's difficult to deal with, but of course, life goes on, and we somehow have to come to terms with it, okay? And one who grieves excessively at the way of the world is a fool. With rare exceptions, the outer limit of grief in Jewish law is a year and not more. And of course, the year is an arbitrary guideline. Obviously, in some cases it takes longer, much longer, and in some cases it might take less. It obviously depends on a whole variety of circumstances, which is why I wanted to just pause briefly and talk about the stages of mourning, at least in Jewish custom. The first stage is called the deep sorrow stage, aninut. It's the period of time between the death and the burial, which for Jews typically occurs very quickly. The only reason it may be delayed is because a loved one's death takes place somewhere which is not close to where they're ultimately going to be buried, right? Like in Dolores's case. Our grave site is in the San Francisco area, south of the city, but Dolores passed away at our home in Jamestown, right? So she obviously, her body was taken by the coroner, the local coroner, and taken to, you know, the facility in Jamestown, and it had to be retrieved by someone who could prepare it for burial, or the organization that prepares Jewish people for burial, and the arrangements for burial are all complete. But there are a lot of things that go on. Typically, we try to bury within 24 hours, but that often doesn't work. You obviously can't do a burial on a Shabbat. And so if it occurs close to a Sabbath, then it's delayed by at least 24 hours because of that. But the deep sorrow stage is the period of time between the death and the burial. After a person is buried, that begins a mourning period of time called Shiva. And you may have heard the expression, when people sit Shiva. When they sit Shiva, they are observing this mourning period. It's a 7-day period of mourning following the burial. But like with all Jewish time, it's not 7 24-hour periods of time. In other words, if an individual is buried in an afternoon, for example, and the Shiva period begins, the family goes home, they sit Shiva, they may get home in the afternoon of the first day of Shiva, right? So at nightfall, the first day of Shiva is complete, right? Even though a family may only have been sitting Shiva for 2 hours. So that 2 hours is counted as a whole day, which is the way Jewish time works. And so at sunset, right, the next day of Shiva begins, and it continues for 7 days. And it is a time of, I would say, relatively intense grief as well. You probably have seen or read of Jews, for example, who sit on low stools during Shiva. They don't bathe. They don't shave. They cover their mirrors. They don't do. They really don't engage in activities that are typical for social interaction, like caring how you look, right? So that occurs. Now, that's something that only Orthodox Jews tend to do. Conservative Jews, they also engage in a Shiva period, but the things that are done are not quite as dramatic. Then there's a 30-day mourning period, Shloshim, that is taken from the story of Aaron because it speaks of the fact that the community of Israel, they mourn him for 30 days. So after the 30-day period of time is over, that's when they move on. So during this 30-day period of time, for example, someone who is mourning the loss of a loved one, they wouldn't go to a wedding, they wouldn't go to a festive occasion. They would go to services. After the Shiva period was over, they would go to services at the synagogue for Shabbat. But they wouldn't go to an amusement park. They wouldn't do other things like that. Things that I remember when Dolores passed away, my daughter and her husband and one of my grandchildren came up to the house, so they were with me for part of this period, and there was an occasion when they just decided a meal had not really been prepared, and they just decided that it would just be easier if they went out and grabbed something to eat, and of course they wanted to take me with them, and I just couldn't go, right? I just didn't want to be around people at the time, right? It just was the idea of being in a restaurant and hearing people talking and laughing and other things that just I just knew that would not be good, right? So I actually told them, "You guys go. I'll take care of Jasper, the grandson. You guys go, and I'll watch the boy, and we'll figure something out. We'll figure something out to eat," which we did, of course. But after the 30 days is over, then people tend to transition back into these kinds of activities. Now, according to Jewish custom, the transition back into these kinds of activities is incredibly, incredibly important. I, like Rabbi Sacks, over the course of my teaching ministry, have had occasion to officiate at many funerals and have had occasion to speak with many bereaved family members and talk to them about what it is that they were going through and experiencing. Right? And of course, I've lost my own father, I've lost my own mother, and those were difficult experiences, and frankly, I still miss both my mother and my father, even though my father has been dead. He passed away 17 years ago, so it's not like it's fresh anymore. But the point is that I know what grief looks like too. And on the occasions when I've had an opportunity to talk to people, I would encourage them not to isolate themselves, because oftentimes that's what people want to do, right? When a loved one dies, especially if it's someone very close to you, the pain is so intense, the grief can sometimes be so intense, that all you want to do is curl up in a ball, turn the lights out, you know, close the blinds, and lay there, right? You don't want to talk to anybody. You don't want to hear a song. You don't want to hear a bird chirp. You don't want to hear anything. You just want to be alone. And you want to weep and you want to cry and you just want to be alone, right? And I would encourage people not to do that, right? It's one thing if you do that for the first 24 or 48 hours, right? But at some point you need to stay connected to people, because in order for the grieving process to be, well, I was going to use the word healthy, right? The grieving individual has to be reintegrated into his life, right? And so it's important to stay connected to people and to keep doing some of the things that you do, right? If you like to read, you should read. If in other words, whatever the things that you did, you know, to derive enjoyment or pleasure out of life, those are the kinds of activities you should try to stay engaged in. So you should continue to go to your congregation and continue to interact with people, even though people oftentimes say stupid things to you at times like this, right? But the point is that you have to somehow separate what they say from their intentions, from their desire to bring you some measure of comfort if they can. But I remember that's exactly the way I felt when Dolores passed away. I've counseled many people, don't curl up into a ball and die. But that's exactly what I wanted to do when Dolores passed away. And it took everything I had to keep going, right? To thank God for Roderick and Joseph, who taught for several weeks, maybe even a couple of months, I think, at that time. But I determined that I was going to continue teaching, as difficult as I knew that would be. And it was. It was very hard, because it didn't feel the same then, right? But somehow this stage of a person's life is just that. It's a stage. And then, of course, in Jewish culture, we have what's called a yahrzeit. It's a Yiddish word, which means anniversary. And so we remember the anniversary of a loved one's passing every year. We typically light a yahrzeit candle on the evening, you know, because the day starts the evening of the day before. And at the synagogue, we go and we say a prayer called Kaddish. It's called the Mourner's Kaddish. It's called the prayer for the dead, even though the dead person is never really mentioned in it. It's a prayer which affirms our confidence and faith in God, right? That God, in spite of the fact that he let this happen, really knows what he's doing after all, because that's, of course, the way it feels. You know, in other words, we know that God is just, we know that God is sovereign, but we're all convinced when a close loved one passes away that this was a mistake somehow, right? I mean, this was, something's wrong. It's different when it's someone else's loved one, right? I mean, when it's someone else's loved one, you know, you just put your arms around them and you trust that God did whatever it is that he did for a reason. But when it's your loved one, then it's very difficult to come to terms with it. At any rate, Rabbi Sacks talks about the own grief that he went through and how difficult it was, and the fact that it didn't help him that he had so much responsibility comforting others and, you know, helping them through their time of grief. He says, yet knowing these things did not help. We are not always masters of our own emotions, nor does comforting others prepare you for your own experience of loss. Jewish law regulates outward conduct, not inward feeling. And when it speaks of feelings, like the commands to love and not to hate, halakha generally translates this into behavioral terms, assuming in the language of the Sefer HaChinuch, which is the book of education, that the heart follows the deed. So Jewish thought tends to put more of an emphasis on behavior rather than on the feelings, right? So he goes on to say, I felt an existential black hole, an emptiness at the core of my being. And I saw this sentence, and I knew that this would have to be the commentary that I would talk about today. Because, of course, I read several commentaries to select the one that I think helps us best understand Jewish thought. And I saw this sentence, and I couldn't help but use this one, because this is exactly the way I felt. I felt an existential black hole, an emptiness at the core of my being, like I had been hollowed out inside, like nothing really made a difference anymore, right? I just continued living. I continued going through the motions, but trust me, that's what most of my life was, going through motions. I knew intellectually that those motions were important. I knew staying connected to my close friends at the synagogue was important. I knew continuing to teach was important. I knew continuing to... my wife was a wonderful gardener, and we had a beautiful garden, a courtyard in the front of our home that she took care of. I mean, she was in that garden every day doing something, right? And so I started. I'm not a gardener. I used to joke with people that plants come to my house to die, right? I mean, my house is like when someone goes home because they're going to be dying in a few days, so they hospice. My house was always hospice for plants, right? I love plants, but I've never been very good at growing them. So anyway, I started working in the garden every day. I started weeding. I started doing whatever it is that you do to make things grow properly, right? Because I just had to do something. And the idea of doing something is an important one. He goes on to say, it deadened my sensations, leaving me unable to sleep or focus, as if life was happening at a great distance, and as if I were a spectator watching a film out of focus with the sound turned off. It was as if life was something that other people lived, but not me. Right? I was a spectator. I watched other people interact. I watched other people live. I watched other people laugh. I watched other people talk. But not me. Right? It was incredibly difficult. He says, the mood eventually passed, but while it lasted, I made some of the worst mistakes of my life. Fortunately, in my case, I didn't make any big decisions during that time. Right? I mean, I didn't buy a house. I didn't, things that would have unintended consequences because I didn't want there to be any, right? But he goes on to say, I mention these things because they are The connecting thread of Parshat Chukat, the most striking episode, is the moment when the people complain about the lack of water. Moses does something wrong. And though God sends water from a rock, he also sentences Moses to an almost unbearable punishment. Because you did not have sufficient faith in me to sanctify me before the Israelites, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given you. The commentators debate exactly what he did wrong. Was it that he lost his temper with the people? Listen now, you rebels. That he hit the rock instead of speaking to it? That he made it seem as if it was not God, but he and Aaron who are responsible for the water? Shall we bring water out of this rock for you? What is more puzzling still is why he lost control at that moment. He had faced the same problem before, but he had never lost his temper before. In Exodus 15, the Israelites at Marah complained that the water was undrinkable because it was bitter. In Exodus 17, at Massah and Meribah, they complained that there was no water. God then told Moses to take his staff and hit the rock. And water flowed from it. So when in our Parsha, God tells Moses, take the staff and speak to the rock, it was surely a forgivable mistake to assume that God meant him also to hit it. That is what he had said the last time. Moses was simply following a precedent. And if God did not mean him to hit the rock, then why did God command him to take his staff? Right? What is even harder to understand is the order of events. God had already told Moses exactly what to do. Gather the people, speak to the rock, and water will flow. This was before Moses made his ill-tempered speech beginning, listen now, you rebels. It is understandable if you lose your composure when you are faced with a problem that seems insoluble, right? When you're facing circumstances that seem impossible, it makes sense to lose your composure, right? I mean, no one would fault someone for that. But this had happened to Moses earlier when the people complained about the lack of meat. But it makes no sense at all to do so when God had already told you, speak to the rock. It will pour forth its water, and you will bring water out of the rock for them, and so you will give the community and their livestock water to drink. In other words, Moses received the solution to the problem, and it was a solution that he had received before, and it worked before, right? In other words, when the people complained about the lack of water before, God told Moses to strike the rock and water would come out. So that's what he did. He struck the rock and water would come out. Why on earth would Moses feel like he was up against an impossible situation, right? When God had clearly brought water forth from a rock on a previous occasion. Do you understand? I mean, it's a really important insight. Why was he so agitated about this problem? When, in fact, it doesn't seem as if he should have been agitated at all. Okay, I get the fact that people get tired of the complaining of others. Frankly, I get that part. And the fact that the nation was always fetching, always complaining about something, or always seemed to be, that can wear on a person. And it helps us to make some sense of this. But the fact of the matter is that Moses becomes agitated in this situation when he doesn't in situations that were far more difficult. Do you understand? At any rate, he says, only after I lost my father did I understand this passage. What had happened immediately before? The first verse of the chapter states, the people stopped at Kadesh. There, Miriam died and was buried. Only then does it state that the people had no water. An ancient tradition, a midrash, explains that the people had hitherto been blessed by a miraculous source of water in the Meret of Miriam, and when she died, that water ceased. Right? So the water that came from that rock continued to flow until Miriam died. At least that's what the Midrash says. Because of how remarkable a woman Miriam was, and because of how great an impact she had, not only on the life of Moses, but on the entire people of Israel, and on the exodus from Egypt. I have a quote from a passage here in the Midrash, the Song of Songs, Rabbah. I'm not going to take the time to read it. Please read it on your own. But it's one of the Midrashim that speaks of this, of what Rabbi Sacks is talking about. Okay? At any rate, he goes on to say, however, it seems to me that the deeper connection lies not between the death of Miriam and the lack of water, but between her death and Moses' loss of emotional equilibrium. Miriam was his older sister. She had watched over his fate when, as a baby, he had been placed in a basket and floated down the Nile. She had the courage and enterprise to speak to Pharaoh's daughter and suggested that he be nursed by a Hebrew, thus reuniting Moses and his mother and ensuring that he grew up knowing who he was and to which people he belonged. Right? Had it not been for Miriam, that may not have happened, and Moses may never have led the Jewish people out of Egypt. Right? And it's not hard to imagine circumstances or things going very differently had Miriam not done what she had done in that circumstance. Okay? So Moses owes his sense of identity to her. Without Miriam, he could never have become the human face of God to the Israelites, lawgiver, liberator, and prophet. In losing her, he not only lost his sister, he lost the human foundation of his life. An incredibly traumatic experience for him. Now, there's another passage in Deuteronomy Rabbah that speaks of Miriam as one of the three redeemers that God appointed to deliver the Jewish people, right? And it even speaks of the prophetic role that Miriam plays in the life of the people in this tractate from the Talmud. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to read either one of those either, but please check these out because they're important, okay? When you are bereaved, Sacks goes on to say, you lose control of your emotions. You find yourself angry when the situation calls for calm. You hit when you should speak, and you speak when you should be silent. Even when God has told you what to do, you are only half listening. You hear the words, but they do not fully enter your mind. Maimonides asks the question, how was it that Jacob, a prophet, did not know that his son Joseph was still alive? He answers, because he was in a state of grief. And the Shekhinah, God's presence, does not enter us when we are in a state of grief. And it doesn't mean that we've been separated from God. It doesn't mean that the Shekhinah is not with us. But I can tell you personally that there have been times in my life when I have felt God's presence so powerfully that I didn't want the moment to end. Right? I could have stayed there in that moment for the rest of my life. And I can tell you that when an individual is in a state of grief, he may do some of the same things that he did before, or she, right? But it just doesn't feel the same. You know that God is with you, but you just don't feel His presence in quite the same way, because the grief is so intense, that emotion is so intense, the feelings are so intense, that it tends to kind of... There's not as much room for God's presence as there is under normal circumstances, right? At any rate, he goes on to say, Moses at the rock was not so much a prophet as a man who had just lost his sister. He was inconsolable and not in control. He was the greatest of the prophets. And this next statement is something that I love about Jewish thought. I love about the Bible. But he was also human. Rarely more so than here. One of the things that I love about Jewish literature, particularly the Bible and rabbinic literature, is how honest it is about people. Right? I mean, the stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and the patriarchs, the stories of Israel's journey from Egypt to the wilderness, they're not sugar-coated. These stories aren't embellished. You would think for a people who are preserving their history, right, that it would be more like, more like some of our stories, right? In which the good details are emphasized and the bad details are, they're ignored, right? Because the good things are good and the bad things are bad, right? So we tend to filter records to reflect these things, but not in the case of Israel. Moses was a man, a great prophet, considered the greatest of our prophets, but he was still a man who still struggled with things, and particularly in this passage, he struggles with the grief associated with the death of his sister. So our parsha, Sachs goes on to say, is about mortality. That is the point. God is eternal. We are ephemeral. We're finite. As we say in the Unatana Tokef prayer on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we are a fragment of pottery, a blade of grass, a flower that fades, a shadow, a cloud, a breath of wind. We are dust, and to dust we return. But God is life forever. This is a beautiful prayer that we recite on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur. And if you've ever been in a synagogue for either one of those services, you probably remember it. Because it acclaims the glory of God and extols His virtues, right? But it also speaks of Him as a sovereign, one on whom on Rosh Hashanah will be inscribed, and on Yom Kippur will be sealed, how many will pass from the earth, and how many will be created, who will live, and who will die after a long life, and who before his time, who by water, who by fire, who by sword, who by beast, who by famine, who by thirst, right? These are things that it is said that God determines at the beginning of each year. And of course, it isn't said because God does determine these things at the beginning of each year. It is said because of the way this paragraph concludes, right? In other words, God determines all of these things in a person's life, but repentance, prayer, and charity annul the severe decree. In other words, you can, by repentance, prayer and charity by doing, you know, by being, you know, by being a person who is motivated by a heart for God, you can have an impact in the way your life, the direction that it takes, right? The things that happen to you. You can have an influence in what happens to you. Now, ultimately, God is sovereign, of course, and we have to ultimately come to terms with the fact that whatever happens, happens, because that's the way God decreed it. But we have an ability to influence things as well. At any rate, at one level, Moses at the rock is a story about sin and punishment. Because you did not have sufficient faith in me to sanctify me. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land I have given you. We may not be sure what the sin exactly was or why it merited so severe a punishment, but at least we know the ballpark, the territory to which the story belongs. Nevertheless, it seems to me that here, as in so many other places in the Torah, there is a story behind the story. And it is a different one altogether. Chukat is about death, loss, and bereavement. Miriam dies. Aaron and Moses are told they will not live to enter the promised land. Aaron dies, and the people mourn for him for 30 days. Together, they constituted the greatest leadership team the Jewish people has ever known. Moses, the supreme prophet, Aaron, the first high priest, and Miriam, perhaps the greatest of them all. What the Parsha is telling us is that for each of us, there is a Jordan we will not cross, a promised land we will not enter. And then Sachs quotes from Pirkei Avot, "It is not for you to complete the task. Even the greatest are mortal," right? So this is a life lesson that we sometimes have to come to terms with. And of course, this is reflected in apostolic literature when Peter says, for example, "All people are like grass. Their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall. But the word of the Lord endures forever." Of course, he's quoting from Isaiah chapter 40, verses 6 and 8. But this idea that it is not for us to complete a task is something that Sachs quotes from Avot, Pirkei Avot, something we have talked about in detail in our Pirkei Avot study. What's interesting about it has to do with some of the commentary about this concept. If you look on the next page of your notes, Rabbi Tarfon comments on his own statement in the previous Mishnah regarding man's overwhelming spiritual tasks in this world. Okay? Now, because it is said, you know, it's not your job to complete whatever task you've been assigned by God to complete, Rabbi Tarfon goes on to say, "One may feel, why should I begin when I will never be able to complete all of my duties? Then why either bother? Why even bother with doing anything? If I may be called from this life to the next before my job is finished, then why even start? Since the day is short and the task abundant, it is useless to try. Therefore, Rabbi Tarfon tells us that we are not absolved of our tasks, even though they seem too heavy for us." And of course, we see this idea reflected in apostolic literature as well, especially when Paul talks about finishing the race, right? When he talks about running the race and finishing the race. But the fact of the matter is that when Paul died, he obviously didn't complete everything that he could have. Imagine had he lived a month longer or 2 months longer or a year longer, or 4 years longer. Do you understand what I'm saying? But of course, that could be said for anyone. In other words, in spite of what happens to us, we have to press forward, right? We have to do what we've been called by God to do, but recognizing at the same time that no one knows when they're going to be called home. No one knows at what stage in their life they will be called home, right? And obviously, when someone is taken far earlier than we think they should have been, then that becomes an incredibly difficult problem to come to terms with, right? But, again, this balance that we have a responsibility to walk in God's ways and to do what we've been called to do, no matter what, right? And we have to recognize at some level that we may not get to complete whatever task has been assigned to us. And we somehow have to come to terms with the way that works in our lives too. That is why the parsha begins with the ritual of the red heifer, whose ashes mixed with the ash of cedar wood, hyssop and scarlet wool, and dissolved into living water are sprinkled over one who has been in contact with the dead so that they may enter the sanctuary. This is one of the most fundamental principles of Judaism. Death defiles. For most religions throughout history, life after death has proved more real than life itself. This is where the gods live, thought the Egyptians. That is where our ancestors are alive, believed the Greeks and Romans and many primitive tribes. This is where you find justice, thought many Christians. This is where you find paradise, thought many Muslims. As Jews, we believe in life after death and the resurrection of the dead. But Tanakh is almost silent on this subject. The dead do not praise God, says the psalm. God is to be found in life, this life, with all its hazards and dangers, bereavements, and grief. Right? God is to be found in life, this life, with all its hazards and dangers, bereavements, and griefs, regardless of what happens to us, God has called us to live, right? Those of us who are left here when our loved ones go to be with the Lord, we still have to live, as difficult as that is sometimes. We have to move on. Obviously, in a way that honors the life of our loved ones and makes it possible for us to somehow enjoy the blessings that God has bestowed upon us, right? He goes on to say, we may be no more than dust and ashes, as Abraham said, but life itself is a never-ending stream, living water, and it is this that the rite of the red heifer symbolizes. With great subtlety, the Torah mixes law and narrative together. The law before the narrative, because God provides the cure before the disease. Miriam dies. Moses and Aaron are overwhelmed with grief. Moses, for a moment, loses control, and he and Aaron are reminded that they too are mortal and will die before entering the land. Yet this is, as Maimonides said, the way of the world. We are embodied souls. We are flesh and blood. We grow old. We lose those we love. Outwardly, We struggle to maintain our composure, but inwardly we weep. Yet life goes on, and what we began, others will continue. One of the sentences that I love in this section is that God provides the cure before the disease, right? And I quote here from a tractate in the Talmud, from the tractate on Passover, where it says that seven things were created before the world was created. They are the Torah, repentance, the Garden of Eden, Gehenna, the throne of glory, the temple, and the name of the Messiah, right? I mean, it's remarkable when you stop and think about it that repentance was created before the first sin in the Garden of Eden, right? I mean, if this isn't an expression of God's grace, then I'm not sure what is, right? I mean, the world is created by God, and frankly, it doesn't take very long before Adam and Eve sin. And of course, it doesn't take very long for the Tower of Babel, or Babel, to be built. It doesn't take very long for the inhabitants of the earth to become so exceedingly wicked that God has to destroy the earth with a flood and save one righteous family, right? The idolatry in the book, well, in many biblical books, in the book of Exodus, it doesn't take very long from the giving of the commandments to the first expressions of idolatry on the part of God's people, right? I mean, frankly, we could say those things about any generation, at any time, at any point in history. But frankly, it's comforting to know that the Messiah pre-exists creation, that his redemptive work was always built in to the way the universe works, right? I mean, because it's not as if any of this has caught God by surprise, right? So things like repentance are in place before the world even exists. And the character of the Messiah, the name of the Messiah, right, who is the active agent of creation, his redemptive work is already something in God's heart before mankind is even created. God creates the cure before the disease. He creates the remedy before the disease. The hard part is us, I don't know the best way to put it, is us waiting for it? Is us trusting God long enough to experience whatever relief might come, that he might provide, right? I mean, it's very, very difficult. At any rate, there is another idea that I wanted to conclude with, too, on the last page. The idea that we are not required to complete our life's work, but neither are we free to withdraw from it, which we just talked about, is a basis for the idea in Jewish thought that we can best remember our departed loved ones by emulating their positive character qualities and living our lives in a way so as to honor them, which is the way Sachs concludes his commentary. Those we loved and lost live on in us, and we will live on in those we love. For love is as strong as death, and the good we do never dies. Right? So, I wanted to add one thing. because many of you have been on this journey with me in the last year and a half. It's been an incredibly, incredibly difficult time because I felt like sacks. I felt like sacks that my life was over, that I would never again experience what I experienced with Dolores. Before Dolores passed away, she told me several times, actually, that she wanted me to find someone to love. She told me that she didn't want me to be alone. Please find someone to love. And I told her, I said, it seemed impossible to me that that would happen, right? You know, I said to her that, you know, how is that possible? You know, it's like being struck by lightning twice. You know, it was more than I was capable of believing at the time, right? And I just never anticipated ever meeting someone that I would imagine could turn out that way, right? But Shelley is someone who has been a part of the Chavura that Dolores led in the Sonora area since it began. And so we've been friends and have known each other for quite some time. And she came to visit me a couple of weeks ago. And for the first time in a very, very long time, I felt a connection with someone that I hadn't felt since Dolores passed away. And we just spent some time together talking. You know, we went on a hike. We did a couple of things. And it was just, you know, it was just a remarkable thing, right? So Shelley and I have decided to kind of see what happens, right? We want to kind of see in what way this relationship may evolve or develop, because we enjoy spending time with each other, right? But it's such a remarkable thing to me that after so long and after feeling empty for such a long time, that the possibility exists that I still have the capacity to feel things that I have long since thought I wouldn't, right? And so I think this portion, this commentary, is particularly meaningful, especially because of what Sachs says at the end, right? Those we loved and lost live on in us. And Dolores certainly lives on in me. And lives on in Shelley as well. And as we live on, just like we live on in those who we love, but for love is as strong as death, and the good we do never dies, right? So as it turns out, there is hope for us all, regardless of how difficult our circumstances and regardless of what it is that we are forced to live with and live through. Okay, so with that, I'm going to stop. Comments, questions? If you have a comment or a question, please raise your hand and I'll unmute your microphone, okay? By the way, one of the observations that Sachs makes is that when his father passed away, I mean, his father was old, his father had been sick, his father had undergone several surgeries, right? I mean, it's not as if he didn't expect his father to die, but But at the end, none of that seems to make any difference. It doesn't make any difference how young or old a person is, right? Whether they are sick or are well, right? I mean, death is a death of a loved one, someone close to you, is incredibly, incredibly difficult. That's why in Judaism there is such an emphasis on a procedure that helps us navigate the way this works.
In this week's parsha and study, looking at it earlier throughout the week, one of the things that I noted was in this instruction of the Lord was to take the staff but speak to the rock. And you've already shown the contrast with the previous occasion where he struck the rock. But I went back to Exodus 4 and remembered the conversation between Moses and Hashem at the burning bush. And speech was one of the arguments that Moses proposed to the Lord that he was not good at.
Yes.
And, you know, it translates that he didn't believe himself to be eloquent in speech.
Yes.
The Hebrew idiom, if I'm correct, is heavy of mouth.
Correct.
And then he was provided Aaron, his brother, and so the Lord would speak to Moses, Moses would speak to Aaron, and then Aaron would speak to the people. Kind of a chain effect here. And then in this moment, you know, Miriam is gone, and the Lord directs him to do the one thing that he doesn't believe he's good to do, that he feels incapable of doing. And instead, he uses the instrument, the tangible instrument, that he is familiar with. And I know that in the work that I do with people, when they are overwhelmed by stress, and in some cases, people who have experienced trauma in their life, our ability, when our brains are overwhelmed and we're experiencing some kind of trauma, we lose connection with the cortical part of our brain, which is the seat of not only our logic and our intelligence, but it's also where our language comes from. And it's not like we can't speak, but our speech is chaotic. And in those moments when we have a sense of panic, we will reach for what is most familiar. In colloquial language, we call it muscle memory.
Yes.
Or in other contexts, we would call it a knee-jerk reaction. I feel like weeping for Moses because it's almost like the striking of the rock was less about something that was intentional, and it was more of a knee-jerk reaction. But still, it came with a consequence. What are some thoughts you have about that, or am I misappropriating something?
No, I think that's a good observation, and I think that it's an observation that kind of fits what Rabbi Sacks was talking about today, right? That when Miriam died, he lost his emotional equilibrium, right? That it was a traumatic event for him. I mean, she played an important role in his life. From the moment he was born, right, until she passed away. And so I think that's a good observation, and I agree with you. And I think that's something that many, many people, including the rabbis, wrestle with. Because Moses was so very faithful to God, and because of this, well, the text makes it seem that because of this one error, you know, one emotional collapse, you know, one, you know, misstep, he doesn't get to enter the promised land. So obviously there's a larger lesson in that for us. And, you know, Moses doesn't get to do what it was in his heart to do. And he has to pass on the assignment to Joshua. Something, by the way, that we have to do too, right? I mean, that's why that passage from Pirkei Avot is so meaningful. Because we all have a work that we will not complete before we leave. And so we have to take steps to raise up others who can carry on in our absence, right? So I think there's something to that in this story as well, which is, I mean, there's so many stories, so many lessons, and the stories and the lessons, though, the lessons come out of articulate observations about what's actually happening. That's important, right? And so I think that observation is true. And in Moses' case, his knee-jerk reaction was to strike the rock. I mean, he was holding the staff, and that's what he did the first time, right? So you are probably right. It was just kind of a... It was probably something he could feel it happening and probably regretted it the instant it took place.
Yeah.
Tina makes a comment. Thank you for this lesson. When my mother passed away, I had a really hard time with it since I was 29 when she passed. I tried to make sense of everything with my faith, with God through Christianity. However, it wasn't until I stumbled upon some Jewish teachings that's what truly helped me through my grieving. So that's... I appreciate knowing that, because that was one of the things that I tried to emphasize, that there, in Jewish thought, we give a place to grieving, which is something we should do. We should grieve, but we place a limit on grieving because we can't allow it to consume us. So there are steps that we are required to kind of engage in order not to be swallowed up by grief and be lost to everyone, right? So it's a very delicate balance, and one that we, you know, one that we all struggle with. Well, okay, I guess we'll call it a afternoon then. I appreciate your feedback and your comments, and I appreciate seeing your faces. That's the nice thing. So with that, I will say lehitraot. I will say see you later. Shelley and I are going to spend the afternoon walking around part of Lake Tahoe. So we're going to enjoy some of the afternoon and some of God's beauty. So Shabbat Shalom. May the Lord be with you. May the Lord bless you with a wonderful week. And Lord willing, I'll see you on Thursday night or on Shabbat. Okay? So, Litrot, we'll see you next time.